Welcome to part three of our conversation with Buddhist Master Joseph Goldstein. And one of the diamonds that I got out of this is Joseph teaching us that when we find refuge in the Buddha, when we find refuge in emptiness, it feels like being lovingly held. You'll love this. Welcome to Deep Transformation, Self, Society, Spirit, life-enhancing, paradigm-rattling conversations with cutting-edge thinkers, contemplatives, and activists, with Dr. Roger Walsh and John Dupuy. Join us in the evolutionary fast lane as we take a deep dive into transformational practice, peak experience, profound understanding, powerful contribution. I have one more thing I can't get away without asking, if that's okay. The idea of refuge. And when I hear that in the Buddhist sense, I think of interior peace. And I don't know if that's, right on or not, but the idea of seeking refuge in the Sangha, in the Buddha, and in the Dharma, that's extremely appealing to me because I'm a good sufferer. I'm really good at,
We all are.
Yeah. But is that something that can be there and present during your whole journey? Although you might be just a little baby, starting to meditate, starting to work on mindfulness, can that refuge that's provided in the transmission of the thousands of years of these people that have been pushing this ahead or going with it, something that we can, dare I say, desire or hope for or experience on the path?
Definitely. For me, a lot of what I notice, over all these years is a deepening of my understanding of refuge. And I think we experience it and we can experience it on a lot of different levels. And just in the last recent period of time, there's one frame which I've really been feeling deeply, refuge as being held. And so, but this is just one level of it. So when I take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha, as I focus on each one, I'm being held by the Buddha and held by the Dharma and held by the Sangha. And even as I'm doing it, I can feel that sense of being held in my body. It's almost like as I'm doing it, I feel my whole system relaxing into being held. But this is on this particular level. There are other levels, we could also talk about. In what I'm talking about now, I envision when I'm doing refuge in this way, I'm envisioning the Buddha as the historical Buddha, having offered teachings. But one could also take refuge in the Buddha nature, so that's not so much the person as just in ultimate truth. So this is why I said, we could relate on different levels and probably at different times we're just drawn to one level or another. But in my old age, I like the sense of being held.
Joseph, one of the points that you just made and you pointed to earlier was that there can be, and hopefully are, deepening understandings of some of the most basic ideas, common ideas. And you just mentioned the idea of refuge, a central practice in Buddhism, the idea of we can trust in the Buddha, the teaching, the community. You also mentioned it before, right at the beginning, you said your understanding of mindfulness had deepened, but we didn't go into that so much. Would you like to say more about that?
Well, I think...
What do you think? You've covered it in various ways.
No, well, I think that I was referring to when I made that comment was just that distinction between perception and mindfulness. Not conflating recognition with being mindful.
A mere intellectual perception is different from mindfulness. That's somehow grokking it, I guess, the user.
Well, I think it's the understanding that in recognition, there can be, as I mentioned, just different filters through which we're seeing something. Whereas in mindfulness, there are not unwholesome fetters or unwholesome states of mind which are acting as a filter. Is that confusing?
Yeah. You're suggesting, and my recollection of some of the fundamental assumptions of Buddhist psychology is that mindfulness, real, and you know, to use some not exact but pointers, really being when one is really mindful, when it's really aware, when there's clear seeing, then the unwholesome mind states, the hindrances, the fetters, whatever names, are inhibited. They don't arise so much. You look. Yeah. I can see you're going to refine my comment.
I mean, it's a really interesting question. I think what you said is accurate. And another point is that with mindfulness, even when the unwholesome states do arise, we're relating to them in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the powers of mindfulness. So,
mm-hmm.
because as we all know, we're practicing and lots of different mind states can arise. But when we're mindful, we're not caught up in them. We're seeing them as just impersonal mind states. So I think that's one of the gifts of mindfulness.
Yeah. And you mentioned before that there'd been a real release for you when you had come to a point of acceptance with aversion.
Yes.
And that seems such an important point. And within the mind, it seems like there are two principles which I've felt are really important to recognize about aversion or resistance to having a particular experience. One is within the mind, what you resist persists. And the second one is what you're unwilling to experience runs your life. And really important principles. And somehow one of the first steps with so many difficult experiences and states of mind is the paradoxical one of letting it be okay to have it.
Absolutely. That's why with my fear thing, and I said, if this fear is here for the rest of my life, it's okay. So it's okay became my mantra about anything, and particularly with unpleasant feelings or emotions or sensation, it's okay. It's okay to feel the unpleasant. So this brings me to one of my favorite teachings of the Buddha, which it just makes me sit up straight because it's such a high bar, but it's a high bar that inspires me, where he said, as long as there's attachment to the pleasant, an aversion to the unpleasant, liberation is impossible. And I just love it because it's so uncompromising, and yet it's addressing some of our deepest, almost hardwired condition. Of course, we don't like what's unpleasant or painful. And of course, we want what's pleasant. This is just the normal way of being a human being. And yet, from the perspective of liberation, this is the conditioning which keeps us bound. And of course, we know, and this comes a lot in, development of the practice in meditation retreat, where even if we haven't reached that high bar of no attachment or aversion, but we can have many experiences along the way when we are experiencing unpleasant things, painful emotions, painful sensations, and the mind is really equanimous. It does not have aversion to it. And the same thing with pleasant. At first, this feels great. I want more of this. But at a certain point, no, the mind is just, it's like space. Pleasant, unpleasant, in a very real way, in those times, becomes equal. Doesn't matter. So even if we're not fully accomplished in it, I think we can all get glimpses and even extended times of experiencing the freedom of that.
Since you've moved us towards the high end of the something or the deep end of the pool, we can continue, because Sean earlier referenced one of the articles you sent us, which was on nirvana, which the idea of the deepest or liberating culminating experience of particularly Theravada and classical Buddhism. And you raised some very interesting things about that. And so I want to just ask first if you'd just say, and here, of course, we're trying to F the ineffable, what can't be described, but can you at least point us towards some understanding of this culminating experience and the very idea of there's a culminating experience of something?
So I'll use a very mundane example that I think everybody can relate to. And it's just obviously an analogy for it. But, you know, I think we've all had the experience of being at home, maybe sitting in the kitchen, and just, you know, nothing much happened, no particular noises or things like that. And we're just sitting, you know, peacefully. And then all of a sudden, the hum of the refrigerator stops, you know, and when it stops, realize that we hadn't even been aware that it was on until it stopped. It was just there, kind of in the background, the ambient noise. But my experience, and I think this is relatively common, when it stops, there is a kind of settling into a different level of peace, of silence. It's like some level of agitation has ceased, right? Just going from that noise to silence. So if we think of this whole mind-body energetic process as being the refrigerator hum, and then we open to the experience, and again, call it nibbana, call it zero, call it emptiness, where the hum of the whole energetic process stops, the experience of that is of such a profound peace. So that's one way of understanding. And the Buddha talked about the highest happiness is peace. And so that experience is like of the ultimate peace, the unborn, the unformed, the unfabricated, the, you know, all those terms for it. But there's another meaning of nibbana, which I think is also really important to talk about, because another way that term is being used is to describe the mind free of defilements. And in the Pali text, there's very specific statements where the Buddha is describing nibbana as the cessation of greed, hatred, delusion. So in that, he's not only referring to that stilling of the hum, but also to the transformative effect on the mind of having had that experience. And then also using the term nibbana to describe that mind that has been freed from these disturbing influences. So it really, I think it's really helpful to understand that it can refer to both aspects. So to that aspect, which we could call transcendent, and the other aspect, I don't know if I'm using this correctly, but could we say the absence of the defilements or the eradication of the defilements, that state of mind is imminent as opposed to transcendent? So I'm not sure I'm using those terms correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they're pointing to something very important, two possible understandings of this. As you point out in your article, the key characteristics of this experience, nibbana, is, and I'll just mention that for various reasons you're pointing out the term, the other term that's often used for it, nirvana, has been so misused in the West now that it's lost a lot of its depth. So sticking with the original Pali term, Nibbana, that this experience has dramatic transformative capacities.
Yes.
Something about this, unique about this experience.
Yes. And what's unique, I mean, there are many things, namely the absence of the hum, but what's also unique about it is that it has the power to uproot the defilements and stages which are causing the hum.
Yeah.
So it has both of those levels, and they're both true. It's not that they're different interpretations of Nibbana. It's just different aspects of what that word refers to.
And what is it that is so distinctive about this experience as compared to the other myriad, as you pointed out, experiences, profound and wonderful, that can occur along the path, that has such transformative power? What is that?
Well, if I'm understanding the question, you're asking, well, why does the experience of Nibbana, uproot the defilements? Mm-hmm. Is that what you think?
Yeah. Why this experience of the millions of others that we have?
So, generally speaking, I don't know if this is going to be a universal statement, but it's where I incline, that why questions are less helpful than what questions.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And so the why it happens, you have to ask the Buddha. The what happens, that anybody who's been through those experiences can tell you what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why, you know, all of the Buddhist traditions, these paths, whatever particular tradition and, you know, unfolding map is used, as you know, these are well-trodden paths. For thousands of years, people have walked on and practiced and experienced the same what. You know, you do this, and then this happens. So that just, to me, seems that's a more answerable question, at least from where I'm at.
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha could probably, undoubtedly, would be able to give you a fuller response.
And he's still around, I take it.
Well,
yeah.
Is that a statement, a question?
No, it's kind of a question and a statement, but it's a deep belief. I think these presences, these great teachers of the past, are in some sense beyond time and are accessible in some mysterious way. And boy, talk about why and how, I don't know. But that's my end.
Uh-huh.
So it's
probably, certainly in different traditions, and even different people within the tradition will have different senses of that. So from a classical Theravada sense, I think the way that what you said would be understood, but it's, I think it may be slightly different than the way you're holding it, where the Buddha said, those who see the Dharma see the Buddha. And so if we're just framing it in terms of, in some way, the Buddha is still around, it would really require a little investigation of what you mean as you're using the term Buddha. If you're using it in some sense as a being on some level, that's one thing. If you're using it as a synonym for the Dharma, that's another thing.
Yeah.
And so people may have different, you know, understandings or beliefs, but it would depend on how they're holding what the term Buddha refers to.
And Joseph, in one of the recurrent themes here has been that so much depends on the way one holds it, one's perspective, one's presuppositions. And you mentioned different paths, and one of the emphases of your article on Nibbana was that, you know, there's controversy about exact interpretations, the way it's held, etc. And even more if we look across paths, because or even within different schools of Buddhism. But looking across paths, there's the assumption in classical Theravadan Buddhism that there is a culminating experience. And if we look elsewhere, say, there can be an assumption that actually there can be a series of culminating experiences, perhaps never ending, always deepening, that each awakening can be a portal to a deeper awakening. I think particularly of in the Buddhist tradition of Dogen, the great Zen master, and in our own time, the teachings of A.H. Almas, who founded the Diamond Work, who's very clear that, you know, to quote him as best I can, well, people ask if I've ever been enlightened. I say, yeah, many times. And people often say, oh, that's the final experience, but I always find there's something more. And it's a different perspective. I'd love to have you.
I have a very simple response to that. And it's actually one of my favorite mantras. Who knows? You know, I mean, we can, even great teachers, who knows? You know, it's like we're having an opinion about, at least with reference to this particular question, about the ultimate end or not end of a path.
Mm-hmm.
So on what basis could anybody claim to have the definitive understanding of that? And so for me, with questions like that, for me, that mantra, who knows, is not one of confusion. It's just one of openness. It's like realizing, I don't know, you know? And so I just keep walking on the path and see what happens.
Well, Joseph, for a not knowing person, your article was amazing. And is that available to just regular mortals out on the street? Can we look Joseph Goldstein Nirvana?
I don't know where it would be found at the moment.
Well, can we release it with this podcast? Would that be okay?
Sure. I don't know how many mortal beings will be interested in it, but you're welcome.
Find out.
Yeah, we'll find out. Joseph, as we've covered a lot here, and let's just take a little time before we end to look back. You know, you've been practicing some 50 years and going as deep as you're just spending a lot of time devoting your life to this in a very wholehearted way. As you look back, are there any reflections you have on I wish I'd known that 20, 30 years or 40 years
yes.
ago?
You know, it's not so much of what I wish I knew then that I know now, because I think that's a whole life is often like that. You know, we make mistakes and then we learn from our mistakes, and that's just the process. But for me, what really has been there from the beginning and has sustained my interest, my deep interest over all these years, is the quality of interest.
Mm.
And, you know, when I first went to India, looking for a teacher, ended up in Bodh Gaya, met Munindraji, my first teacher. And he said something that was just so simple and so straightforward. It completely hooked me. And I was young. I was just, I think, 23 at the time. He said, if you want to understand your mind, sit down and observe it. There was nothing to join. There was no ritual, no ceremony, nothing. If you want to understand your mind, sit down and observe it. And it just made so much sense to me, because how else can we understand our minds, ourselves, our being, except by it's not limited to sitting down. We could do it standing up or lying down. But it's that process of interest in our own inner experience. And as I said, you know, earlier, not to waste our suffering and having the difficulties and the challenges actually piquing our interest. You know, oh, can I understand this? So that's for whatever reason, that's been a part of my makeup from early on, but I so appreciate it because it sustains, it's just sustained this incredible interest in deepening, ever deepening understanding. So to me, that's the key. You know, if people understand a methodology that works for them and they're interested enough to keep walking on the path, in a way, liberation is inevitable. You know, because as we said, this has been a well-trodden path. So that just gives me a lot of joy, you know, and it's so fulfilling in life because we're just taking all of our life's experience, whatever it is, you know, the great times and difficult times, you know, but it all becomes, as Ram Dass would say, grist for the mill. You know, it's all part of it. And so to me, it's just a really fulfilling way of life.
I resonate completely, and I think one of the hooks for me has certainly been something similar. I've called it curiosity, but I think interest. And it seems that we underestimate the value and potency of interest as a quality of mind. And it's brought home to me by a woman, Anjali Zarian, who was a wonderful Basque shaman, a very wise woman. She led groups of reconciliation groups around the world, in Ireland and in South Africa. And I had the good fortune of being at a dinner with her just after she'd led what she just, as we were talking, she said was the most difficult group she'd ever led. I was like, whoa, this is a woman who's been through the fire. And so, of course, I wanted to know, well, what did you do? And she said, I kept saying to myself, stay interested. Stay interested.
Yes, 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 yeah. You know, just to tie that quality of interest back to the classical teachings, it's actually one of the factors of enlightenment. It's called the investigation of dhammas, investigation of the truth of the elements, you know. So it's right there as a kind of key element of the whole path. And certainly, I feel it's borne out in, you know, in our experience.
Yeah. Joseph, as we kind of close, I wonder if I'd like to just have your reflections on the kind of more the application of some of these insights and ideas and practices to the larger issues. You know, we're in a new time in human history, which the first time in history, the very civilization, world civilization, is at risk because of the very foibles, human foibles, the greed, hatred, delusion, neuroses, etc., that you've devoted, and this whole Buddhist path has devoted its being to understanding. And yet the responses to the great threats of our time, whether they're nuclear war or starvation or pollution or ecological collapse, almost invariably are outer responses, political, military, economic, etc. And the underlying psychological and spiritual dysfunctions get overlooked. And yet, if we look deeply, it seems like our global problems are actually global symptoms. They're symptoms of our individual and collective psychological, spiritual dysfunctions. And if we only respond to the symptoms, the underlying dynamics are just going to keep perpetuating or even exacerbating problems. So I'd love to have your reflections on these great issues.
Well, I totally agree with what you just said. You know, that, and the Buddha kind of, he laid it out very clearly, is the root causes of suffering in the world are greed, hatred, and delusion, and all the manifestations of those states. And I totally agree with you that the real resolution will be the growing ability of more and more people to be looking deeply, you know, into their own minds and working to diminish and eventually eradicate. Part of my frame, and this is how to say this, I think for many people in the West, they will not be able to relate to what I'm about to say. It definitely comes out of the Buddhist teachings, but it's not a part of the teachings that are very accessible to most people. And even for myself, they're really taken on faith at this point. But as the teachings have been expressed in the West, the part that we almost always leave out is the whole Buddhist cosmology, you know, and kind of different planes of existence and rebirth and different world systems. So the cosmology is vast. And when you read the texts, it's right there. It's almost on every page. You know, the Buddha interacting with beings from all different realms of existence and describing the larger cosmology. Now, I understand that to many people in the West, especially kind of with the Western scientific paradigm, unless one has developed the mind to such an extent that can be those aspects, the cosmological understanding, can be experienced directly, it's understandable that people are very skeptical about this. And we don't talk about it a lot, you know, for just that reason. But I'm just sharing my own personal, for me, and it's not that I've had experience of all that, but both because it's my inclination, having really studied a lot of the teachings and seeing how embedded these understandings are, and having practiced with teachers, have cultivated their minds to the extent where they can experience all that. So I'm putting this out because, and again, this is just very personal. I understand that it may not be the way most people can hold it or even maybe interested in holding it. But for me, that very large, you know, vast understanding of the nature of the universe in many mysterious ways, mysterious to us now, gives a very different perspective on what's going on. You know, and for me, it's a help for me, even as I, you know, do my life's work is in trying to share the Dharma and help people really look at purifying the mind. But this much more vast sense of what's going on, it's a source of a kind of equanimity that can hold the tremendous amount of suffering that is just on this planet at this time, you know. And this again is a very interesting, somehow, I think it's been helpful for me to integrate kind of this hugely vast perspective with what the moment calls for in compassionate response. You know, because a danger of that vast perspective is we become indifferent. Okay, you know, this planet's going to blow up in 4.5 billion years anyway. You know, and there are other planes of existence and all of that, which I believe to be true, but that doesn't negate the imperative to address the actual suffering that's going on now. But it can help us hold it in a different way and in a more equanimous way, even as we respond with as much compassion as possible. And so it's this balance of equanimity and compassion, which I think makes possible effective response.
Beautiful. Yeah, thank you very much. So
I was very moved by that. What a wonderful summation.
Yeah.
Thank you. Good question.
Yeah. Thank you, Joseph. So just to acknowledge the beauty of that again, one of the magical words that's come up several times, integration, the holding of the biggest possible perspective, opening to the biggest experience and understanding we can, while simultaneously working as skillfully and effectively as we can, both on ourselves to attenuate the causative dysfunctions that lie at the root of our global tragedies, and simultaneously working in the world to relieve the issues and the underlying causes. Yeah, beautiful. Thank you. Joseph, this has been such a gift. It's so much fun just to sit down with you and investigate or bring interest to all number of topics, as you said. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. It is a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I just feel really honored to be in the presence of both of you, two elders who've just been on this path for a long time, and it's really been good for me. And I'm sure that our listeners are going to find the same sort of goodness from participating in this. So thank you so much, both of you.
Oh, thank you. What a gift.
Thank you very much for being a part of this conversation. We hope that you were moved as we are moved being part of it ourselves. We'd also like to say that this is being funded by Roger and myself. It comes out of our pockets. So if you would like to help us to mainly to get this podcast out to more people, because the bigger audience have, which is steadily growing, but the more people we can reach and the more marketing we can do, the more positive effect we can have on the world. So we've done a couple of ways, but we'd like you to buy us a cup of coffee. Very simple. And I do that with podcasts that I support, and I find it's very satisfying. So thank you for your help. Thank you for your presence, and thank you for all you are and all you do. We love you.